call the next case.
Anderson versus Billman, Ortiz, et al.
All right, the appellant has waived argument, so you can say almost anything you want.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Michelle Callen for the defendant's appellees. Recognizing that I have no friend on the other side this morning, I'd just like to raise 2 points for Your Honors. One, related to procedural due process, Mr. Anderson has failed to assert a procedural due process claim. And even if this Court concludes that he asserted a protected liberty or property interest that rises to the level required in the prison disciplinary context, Mr. Anderson received any and all process to which he was due. And second, Your Honors, all the defendants in this case are entitled to qualified immunity. On the first point, procedural due process, courts recognize that in the context of prison disciplinary proceedings, prison officials are balancing both the interests of the inmates, but also the interests of security and management concerns in the prison context. For that reason, the liberty or property interest that must be asserted to state a procedural due process claim in the context of prison disciplinary proceedings is higher than in typical circumstances. The asserted deprivation of a liberty or property interest must be something that is atypical in the ordinary incidents of prison life. In this case, Mr.
And counsel, it's kind of a more of a gray area than a clean circuit split, but there seems to be a divergence of views about whether this kind of property deprivation falls within more recent U.S. Supreme Court case law as opposed to a liberty interest.
So I think the 2 points on that, Your Honor. As an initial point, Mr. Anderson, in his brief on appeal, recognizes that the liberty and property interests are parallel.
I think that's right. I can't think of a good reason why you would draw a distinction, but some courts clearly have.
That's correct, Your Honor. And our view is that the United States Supreme Court reasoning in the Sandin case is applicable here, that both a liberty and property interest must rise to the level of an atypical and significant hardship in relation to the ordinary incidents of prison life. And that makes sense in the context of the prison situation, wherein we regularly deprive prisoners of both liberty and property interests. So, for example, when somebody initially comes into the prison and has a cell phone with him or her, that cell phone, that piece of property, is deprived as part of the ordinary incidents of prison life. So a manufactured distinction between liberty and property in terms of whether or not that deprivation has to rise to the level of something atypical in the incidents of prison life, our view is that reasoning applies both to liberty and property.
One of the things that was a bit unclear about is, I'm familiar with checking and savings account and so on, and there's all kinds of statutes on that. Presumably an inmate account is different, but there was just really nothing in the record or in the briefs. And just to draw an analogy, there's that Third Circuit case where they were at some pains to come up with a deprivation of a property interest there, looking at, banking and other debtor law, to draw an analogy to these inmate accounts, but that's, Pennsylvania and Virginia may be completely different. I mean, all that to say, I don't have a clue what the actual property interest that an inmate has in that account, because it may well be they sign something when they come in that says you can use this for toothpaste and other lawful things, but by golly, if you test positive for opiates, you forfeit any or all of it, in which case seems like they wouldn't have any real property interest in it. So when we're talking property interest, it has to be tethered to some kind of law or regulation. And I just wasn't sure with these inmate accounts if there even was one, or if there was one, what it was.
To the extent there was one, Mr. Anderson has failed to point to any connection that establishes in this context a property interest in inmate accounts. But we would draw the court's attention to the various sister courts in the chorus of opinions that have held that $12 fines, which are more than the $10 fine at issue here, don't rise to that level.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Tell me if I'm missing the forest for the trees. If, forget your case for a second and think of a completely different hypothetical, a civil case in circuit court, and the trial judge has a tort claim that he's dealing with, and he rules for the plaintiff and awards $100,000, not $10, but $100,000. And the appellant comes up on appeal and says, you know what? This trial judge failed to enforce the discovery rules, and I didn't get documents in my request for production. He didn't grant my motion to compel, and I didn't get them, and I needed them. We've said, and it's been said, it's never not been said, that's not a constitutional issue. You do not have a constitutional right to discovery. Why are we even getting caught up in the esoterics of due process when it doesn't apply at all categorically to a discovery default? This is all this is. He didn't get his chain of custody document. All right, so what? You probably should have, but you didn't. But that's not a constitutional violation, particularly in the context of a prison infraction case. Wait, why isn't that the obvious answer? I must be missing something, because the briefing is far more complex than that very simple paradigm.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that's an exact... That's a perfectly reasonable way to view this case. This is a question of access to a particular piece of evidence. And that's why even if Mr. Anderson did somehow assert a proper liberty or property interest deprivation...
I mean, losing $10, losing $100,000, it sort of depends on who you are.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in the context of prison disciplinary proceedings, the process that is due was set forth by the United States Supreme Court in Wolfie McDonnell, and it sets forth four requirements. Mr. Anderson does not challenge any one of those four requirements.
The thing I'm struggling with, the process that's due outside of the prison context is not any different. For example, if the next case came up and the person came to the podium and said, Your Honor, I just got hit with a $100,000 civil verdict. My trial judge hit me with $100,000. I needed a piece of evidence, the chain of custody document XYZ. And I really did need it. And let's assume he really did need it. But the trial judge didn't give it to him. That's not a constitutional case. We would say, okay, your assignment of error on due process gone because you don't have a right to discovery. Now, whether he abuses discretion, that's a whole different subject. If that is true, if I've not overgeneralized that, how much more true is it in the context of your case?
It would be even less. It would be more true, Your Honor, in the sense that prison disciplinary proceedings have even less process that's due than in other contexts.
Right. And so if he loses $10, sorry, but there's no due process issue. He doesn't lose any liberty because he has no idea how it's going to affect his good time credits or his length of sentence or anything else.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It's not $10. It's $12.
Oh. Forgive me.
Well, here in this case, Your Honor, it is $10, but the cases to which we cite include $12, which is $2 more.
I don't think we're going to be drawing any lines based on those thresholds. Thank you for that.
But just to discuss the process that is at issue here, the process which Mr. Anderson was due was minimal, and as Justice Kelsey pointed out, does not include access to evidence, as Mr. Anderson asserts here. The process is fourfold. First is advance written notice of the charges against him, and the record actually reflects the exact form that Mr. Anderson himself signed.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but it's not quite that simple. If a trial judge in a civil case were to say, you're not putting on any evidence, we're going to have a trial, but the other side's going to put evidence, and you're not going to put on any evidence, I'm not going to allow you to. That would be a due process violation. But if it's just, I'm not going to allow you to put on this witness because you didn't give me his name and enough time for the cutoff or whatever, or I'm not going to enforce the subpoena because you got all the information you need, and I don't really need to hear it, blah, 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 then there's no due process. So he got this opportunity to put on evidence. He just didn't get one thing he wanted within that.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And he does not contest that he received the process that was due to him. It was a minimal process, and he received exactly that process. Rather than contesting the claiming that he had some sort of constitutional that there was a process that was denied that raises to a constitutional violation, he just points to a particular piece of evidence he wanted that he didn't receive, and that does not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. It might be helpful also to think about the particular form that he was seeking and why the form is not this linchpin to the case that he even claims it is. So Mr. Anderson asserted a concern that he was subject to a false positive urine test, and he believed that this particular form would falsely state that he was not taking any medication. And that is why he wanted access to the form, because he could say, there's a chance that my urine test was positive because I actually was taking medication, and the medication I was taking could yield this false positive urine test, positive for opiates. But when he testified to that effect in his disciplinary proceeding, rather than entirely disregard that argument, the hearing officer actually stopped the hearing, went and spoke to medical officials, and asked the medical officials of the prison, is Mr. Anderson taking any medication that could yield a false positive urine test for opiates? And the medical official was clear that Mr. Anderson was not taking such medication. And so even if Mr. Anderson received this form that he thinks is so crucial to his case, and even if it said what he claims it said, which improperly checks a box that says no medication taken, it's not this linchpin to showing that he was subject to a false urine test. So first, he has no constitutional entitlement to that form and has not stated a constitutional claim for failure to receive that form. But it's also helpful to understand the context of what this form is and what this form could or couldn't have done in his case. But even if this court concludes that Mr. Anderson did in fact state a procedural due process claim, none of this was clearly established in under this court, and for that reason, all of the defendants here are entitled to qualified immunity.
We had a recent reminder from the U.S. Supreme Court that we shouldn't draw the line at too high a level of abstraction when determining. I mean, I just saw on a blurb that they reversed the U.S. Court of Appeals for drawing the duty, existing duty, at too high a level of abstraction. Said you got to go down a little more to figure out. And I think that goes to your point of, you know, for these officials trying to figure out what their duties are, they need some kind of concrete line for what they're supposed to do and not do, as opposed to, well, you should be fair to inmates or whatever.
Exactly, Aaron. And in this court, Mr. Anderson failed to point to any case law from this court that establishes the elements of his due process claim. So that doesn't give officials notice, even a reasonable officer notice, that what happened here violates Mr. Anderson's procedural due process rights. Unless this court has any additional questions, we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Call the next case.